temptation and its
Remember,
consequences, as we are about to see that as the Honourable Leader of the
I
Opposition,
will be the first soul
Honourable
to admit
Kennedy answered.
that these are not easy times for any government that is in office today, whether in the world or in the Caribbean. I envy no government, no prime minister, no minister of finance. But one thing is clear. These are the times that will help us to discover and understand the quality and the character of the men and women who govern our affairs. A crisis can either make us or break us. Crisis can confirm good, solid leadership. Equally, the crisis can expose flawed character, flawed leadership, and flawed vision. There can be no doubt that our region and St. Lucia is faced with an economic crisis of unprecedented proportion. The International Monetary Fund only recently said that this is the worst recession since the Second World War. When one looks over the last 12 months, the temptation is to ask the question, or to exclaim at least, what a difference a year has made. Mr. Speaker, the reactions from the Caribbean were interesting. From the north, Jamaica, to the south, to Suriname, and South America, government denied routinely that there was a crisis. They all felt they had it under control. Now the admissions are coming one by one. The latest is that the government of Trinidad and Tobago, through its central bank governor, has indicated to the people of Trinidad and Tobago that there will be negative growth in Trinidad this year, and that the government of Trinidad and Tobago will have to borrow substantial sums of money to catalyze and resuscitate the Trinidad and Tobago economy. And if this government is seeking comfort, then obviously the latest budget of the Minister of Finance of Jamaica is instructive. Because in that country, they have had to take the most drastic measures a government has taken since the turbulent years of the 1973. The government of St. Lucia was no exception. Last year, this time, the Minister of Finance forecasted in the famous karaoke budget a 7% GDP growth for 2008-2009. Today, 12 months later, the people of St. Lucia are told that GDP growth is estimated at 0.7% for 2008-2009. That the government of St. Lucia cannot say increases to its employees, at least not at this time, and that the economy, it is acknowledged, is in crisis. No one in his or her right mind or in their right senses would deny that the global economic crisis has adversely impacted the solution. And it is utter foolishness to deny this or to pretend otherwise. What has happened is that this crisis has adversely affected St. Lucia and narrowed our choices and our options. That there can be no doubt and no question. In a crisis budget, therefore, what becomes essential is what choices we make and what choices or what options we accept. It becomes a question what project you finance and do not finance. It becomes a question where do you grant concessions to spur economic activity and where do you pull back to discourage certain patterns of economic activity. In my view, even if we did not have this global recession to contend with, our economy in St. Lucia would still have been in trouble. It would have been in trouble because of the issue of trust, the issue of confidence, because of the failure to articulate clear policy when it was most needed. And that shall be the thrust of my submission. For many St. Lucians, this is a puzzling budget. This economy is supposed to be in crisis from the words of the Prime Minister. But the budget is hardly crafted to deal with the crisis at hand. It does not deal with the burning problems facing the people of St. Lucia. It just ignores it. We are told nothing about the unrelenting crises that ordinary St. Lucians face and how people are supposed to react to these crises. We are not told why prices in the Eastern Caribbean is going down and why prices somehow in St. Lucia remain stagnant. We are not told how we're going to deal with the massive unemployment increasing day by day, whether in tourism or elsewhere. We are not told that there's an emerging problem in our banks, that liquidity is becoming tighter and tighter and tighter. We are not told about the defaulting number of St. Lucians who are unable to pay their credit cards and their loans, and day by day the number being taken to the courts in this country continues to rise and increase with no mercy from the banks. We are not told of the increasing shortage of foreign exchange in the system. And everybody's afraid suddenly to talk about the problem of foreign exchange. We all live in the comfort that somehow the Eastern Caribbean Central Bank has it all worked out where foreign exchange is concerned, when our prime earner of foreign exchange, tourism, is now undergoing major contraction. No one can go into these banks at this time and ask for the equivalent of 250,000 ET dollars in US dollars with comfort. There are beginning to be problems. And my good friend from Sufre drew our attention to the increasing levels of indigency. What is most alarming is that the fiscal crisis at the heart of the operations of central government is left on its own, with no direction as to how that matter will be addressed, except not to pay public officers the increase granted to them in August last year. In examining any budget, Mr. Speaker, one has to evaluate what is said and also what is deliberately left on self. It is true that a minister of finance has choices in determining what he addresses in a budget. He may decide to leave out some items because his other parliamentarians can follow up with these items. But what is often left unsaid provides clues, vital clues, to what sometimes can be tantamount to economic subterfuge or fiscal deception. Perhaps I can give two examples where the Minister of Finance is ominously silent. In the recurrent revenue estimates, the government plans to increase the intake of property tax from $2.72 million in 2008-2009 to $10 million in 2009-2010. An astonishing increase, possibly between 300 and 400%. Yet, not a word to unsuspecting households and to taxpayers in a period when everyone in this country is reeling from the crisis that has engulfed them. And I'm very happy that the Minister of Communications and Works has rejoined us. I will have more to say about his contribution in due course. But unless I am blind, Mr. Speaker, I see no evidence in the estimates of the cost of repaving the East Coast Road from Canal to Prale. Yet, construction and rehabilitation is on the way. There seems to be no specific project in the capital estimate so that we can get a sense of what is the cost of this project. Equally, we are in the dark about the terms of financing of this project. How is this project being financed? Is it being financed from the $30 million which the government borrowed from the Caribbean Development Bank? Or is it the case that the contractor is financing the road for the government to pay the contractor several months later? And if that is the case, is this not a loan that ought to be brought to the house? Why is it that the terms have never been made public? I really want the answers. Because you see, interestingly, this project has been awarded to a French company, Gardacan. And I recall a company ruthlessly attacked by the Minister of Communications and Works in the budget address of 2007. Among other things, in that Hansard report, he wanted to find out why it is that the then government awarded Gardacan the contract to repave the area around the marketplace. What was this magic? And today, they have a contract to repave the East Coast Road. That contract, true, it has been mentioned by the Prime Minister in his budget statement. But we cannot identify what the cost is and the terms of construction. Then a more recent one. A sign at the commencement of the Alan Bosque Highway from Shock announces the rehabilitation of the Alan Bosque Highway by a company that has suddenly appeared on the construction scene, Asphalt and Mining St. Lucia Limited. Yet again, I searched in vain for a specific allocation in the capital estimate. I could find none. Why? And I shall return to this matter in a few minutes. In typical fashion, The Minister of Finance has proudly announced that his bookkeeper has produced a balanced budget. Indeed, if you look at the financial summary, you will see the figures suggest it is balanced. But you know, the easiest thing to do is to balance a budget on paper. That is the easiest thing to do in the world. What is not easy is to hide a hole in the economy, is to hide a fiscal deficit that exists. No matter what you do, how you twist, how you turn, you will eventually be found out. The fact of the matter is that the Prime Minister and Minister of Finance has indicated that the government of St. Lucia is unable to pay the balance of the 14.5% award to public servants. The Minister has also announced new appointments, that new appointments have been frozen. Clearly, the gap between recurrent revenue and recurrent expenditure, or if you prefer technical language, the recurrent deficit, which, of course, we have never ever been told in this budget, is far greater than the $25 million owed to public servants. And this is the crux of our crisis. What is the true fiscal deficit? But the Prime Minister and Minister of Finance proposes to close his deficit by borrowing a total of EC $265,000,000, $959,414. A resolution before this Parliament, which incidentally is illegal, seeks approval for bond lending in the amount of $196 million. Yet, the capital estimate indicates that EC $145,841,182 will be utilized in capital expenditure. What then is being financed by the balance of EC $50,159,818? To date, we have not been told where is this amount going and to do what. Mr. Speaker, the fact is, when an economy is in trouble, when an economy is in crisis, the Minister of Finance must lay all his cards on the table. The people of St. Lucia need to be told the full extent of their predicament. They need to know. Now more than ever, they feel the need to have leadership that they can trust, leadership that is bold and confident, leadership that is fair, just, and equitable. This is not the time to play cheap, dishonest politics. It will not help the situation, whether it comes from the opposition or whether it comes from the government. This is not the time to engage in statistical subterfuge or to be economical with the truth, unless I am accused of exaggerating, then I cite two instances of what I speak. I'll take them in turn. Repeatedly, in public and on statements made on the radio, The Minister of Finance and the Prime Minister said that the government of St. Lucia is unable to pay increases to public officers because of a decline in revenue from the customs department. An unchallenged statement. Cannot pay because of a decline in revenue in the customs department. He says, Mr. Speaker, at page 43 of the budget statement as follows. Quote, there has been, at page 43, a steep decline in revenue, particularly from customs duties. Page 43. These are his words to this Honorable House. But his own estimates of expenditure tell a totally different story. There is an obvious gap, a yawning gap, a mismatch between what the Prime Minister says and his own statistics. Take page 9 of the revenue estimate. Take page 9. Take page 9. In 2007 to 2008, the year under that review, taxes on international trade, and that includes import duty, consumption tax, service charge, throughput charges, airport tax, environmental protection levy, excise tax, security charge, SLAFPA. In 2007-2008, the amount collected by the Customs and Excise Department was $354,867,933. And I repeat, I am on the taxes on international trade. $354,867,933. That's for 2007-2008. The revised estimates for 2008-2009 show the amount collected to be $375,000,000. $323,530. In effect, the Customs Department made at least EC $20,455,597 over the amount collected in the previous year. If you look at taxes on domestic sales, you want another category, the same picture emerges. In 2007-2008, $16,011,693. Again, in 2008-2009, $16,623,448. Again, a surplus possibly estimated at over $500,000. The same story, the same picture in respect of fees, fine and forfeiture. Where then is the steep decline that the Prime Minister talks about? This has been the justification for not paying public officers the increase. It is clear that there was no steep decline. All that may have happened was that the government may have decided for their own reasons to forecast a certain amount to be collected. They did not reach that target. That is all that could have happened. But if you are talking about decline, you have to measure it against the previous year, and there is no decline. That's the reality. His own economic and social review contradict him. This document prepared by his office contradicts him. Tells him that his statement is wrong. Unless you believe that this is an exaggeration, I ask you to turn to page 5. The last paragraph, it says, in 2008-2009, total revenue and grants rose by 9.6% to $816 million, or 31% of GDP, following a growth of 12.1% in 2007-2008. All that had happened was that the increases may have slowed, but there were increases. His own social and economic review tells him that what he's saying to the people of St. Lucia is wrong, it's not true. When the Prime Minister and Minister of Finance crowed about his management of public debt, and it would appear in this budget debate that that is going to become the linchpin of the response of the government. Instead of facing to the reality of the crisis at hand, they want to revisit debt to blame the Labour Party for the mess they have created over the last 2 years. But tanto tanto, we shall come there. Temptation was too good, too great. Listen to the Prime Minister at page 7 of his address. The last paragraph. The increase in debt at a slower rate than nominal GDP, a point championed by the Minister of Communications and Works. And I had the good fortune of listening to him driving up here on the radio, so I was one to reply. Gave rise to a lower ratio of public debt to GDP of 65.8% at the end of 2008 compared to 67.3% in 2007. So, Prime Minister, you're wrong. You're wrong. The ECCD tells you a different story. This ECCD is the official source of authoritative information on these matters. And I will quote the debt figures from the Eastern Caribbean Central Bank, which is available on the net for anybody who wants it. These are the figures. I'm coming to them. I'm coming down to them, Mr. Speaker. Total public sector outstanding debt in percent of GDP. In 2000, for the government of St. Lucia, or 2001, by the way, total public sector debt, the same debt to user ratio to determine that ratios. 2000, 45.7, 2001, 51.2, 2002, 57.8, 2003, 63.5, 2004, 70.3, 2005, 70.3, 2006, 70.7, and may I pause? Just to explain to you, because I heard you. If you notice between 2004 to 2006, the net increase was 0.4 only. So there was no magic. Absolutely no magic. And then 2007, 73.9, going back down to 2008, 70.1. Where does the Prime Minister get his figure? Where does the Prime Minister get his figure of 67%? So it is clear that it stood the debt GDP ratio stood at 73.9%, not 67.3%. And she claims, as I said, what big achievement is there because you say you have borrowed less when in truth and in fact a multiplicity of factors could account to this, and you have had virtually no growth in debt between the years 2004 to 2006. But then, instead of coming to this house and say, listen, gentlemen, instead of speaking to this country, do if you wanted an Obama, just as you got Obama to autograph this book for him, he could have been inspired by an Obama and say to this house, we are in a deep hole. The only options that governments have at this time is to borrow to get out of the hole. Will you consider cooperating with us in that situation to borrow? No. No. That's not the approach. In crisis, there is an argument for saying that you have to get the politics right before you get the economics right. In peacetime, you get the economics right and you get the politics to follow. Of course, there are some who may not believe in that theology. But there is no occasion in the life of a country when we have to get the politics right than in a moment of crisis. What is the situation? We can say what we want. When we assess Obama in this period, the United States, Obama will go down in history as the president who borrowed the most amount of money in living history in the United States to save the American economy. The IMF has said that if the UK government did not borrow the huge sums that it did, the UK economy would have collapsed. That is why you get your politics right and you do not play politics at this stage with people's lives and with figures. We on this side of the house may have adopted a totally different posture and say to you, look, we are in this together, we understand the situation, we will find common ground. But you don't give us that opportunity. What you do is to assail, attack us. And the same trend is maintained by my good friend, the Minister of Communications and Works. I shall come to him in a few minutes. I have good reasons for saying that. But watch the warning in your Social and Economic Review. Watch the warning at page 79. Watch what they tell you. They tell you after you finish throwing for a few minutes, consequently, and I repeat the whole paragraph, the fiscal position of central government is expected to deteriorate with lower revenues coupled with higher current and capital expenditures in support of the implementation of counter-cyclical policies. Consequently, the required borrowing will lead to an increase in overall debt level in 2009. Come back next year to this house. You borrow 269 million, you'll come back next year. And I have no doubt it will reach staggering proportions. But I will come back to this. In passing, I just want to draw attention, and I know, I don't think the Minister of Labour has spoken yet. In passing, there's one item of recurrent revenue which attracts some attention. It's the issue of work permit fees. In 2007-2008, the government of St. Lucia earned $5,643,760 in work permit fees. In 2008-2009, the estimated amount was $4,276,726. The forecast for 2009-2010 is $2,197,628. Why? Is it because the economic downturn is so severe that people are packing their bags and leaving? Or is it more generosity? Or is it that it is becoming difficult to police those who are breaking the law? I'm certain at the appropriate time we should get some answers. What is clear is this. When we are undergoing the challenges that face us, such as the one before us now, we need, as I indicated, to make sensible choices and exercise prudent options. For the first time, every single project will have to be evaluated to determine whether that project is going to assist in blocking the economic hole that we have in our fiscal operations. This budget, as I indicated, has been extraordinary in some respects. For me, it is a little astonishing to see the similarity of some of the projects which have undergone name changes. Some are simply copy and paste. In one instance, requiring a change in the commencement date from what was in an earlier budget, and others were heavily criticized in the past when we suggested them, and now with a little tweak, they are reintroduced. That's the new economic theology and the new economic approach. But the reality is that we are in different times. That's the bottom line. It is well known that a great idea at the wrong time is a bad idea. Or to be generous to the government is just not good enough. We call on the government during the middle of 2008, when the financial crisis in the United States and Europe were emerging into a global economic crisis, that we needed to take immediate action to shield St. Lucia and position us to minimize the consequences on our public finances and the general state of the economy. It was needed then to avoid the situation that we are in today. It is that failing that has led to this crisis of confidence from investors, international donor agencies, financial institutions, and your own public officers. Tell me, Mr. Minister of Finance, why is the government of St. Lucia proposing to spend EC 32.5 million on the Daher building while people are unable to buy food and medicine? If this sum of money is to be spent on this building, then surely it means that the government of St. Lucia has bought the Daher building. Why is it that the government of St. Lucia has refused to confirm or deny the purchase and the terms and conditions of the purchase of that building? Why is it not public knowledge? What is secret about it? Why was a company created in secret to manage that building and no one knows the names of the directors? You have this distinguished example and you'll find out in time. We'll find out in time about St. Lucia Asphalt and Mining. If we are in crisis, why is the government of St. Lucia spending $5 million in agency administration in the Ministry of Finance, $1 million in office furniture and equipment, another $900,000 in computer equipment, and $190,000 in improvements to the Graham Luigi Administrative Building? Why? We are in crisis. Is it not more important that whatever resources that you get, that you achieve consensus between the key players and direct those resources to economic activity to avoid the inevitable collapse of this economy? Isn't that the choice that we should be making? Consider too the allocation to national development in the capital estimate. I want to turn the chain to page 522, Madam Speaker. Page 522, if you care to follow. The question that I really want to ask is whether the allocation to this phantom ministry is in the best interest of the country at this time when we are in crisis. Whether it would not have been better for some of the money allocated to this head ought not to have been directed or redirected to a Ministry of Communications and Works, or indeed to a Ministry of Youth and Sports to tackle vital needs in the society. Under the heading National Development, Special National Development Project Unit, an allocation of $2,050,730. Northeast Quadrant Economic Development, they can't let go, $2,445,210. Central Region Economic Infrastructure Tunnel Connectors, $1,358,450. Castries Economic Development Program, $2,823,444. National Development Planning Framework, $1,384,994. Sociological Data Capture Project, what on earth that is? What on earth that is? $4,509,925. And my good friend, National Health and Wellness Tourism Study, $270,000. And categorically, let me say I support that one. Categorically. Let me explain what I'm trying to say to this Honorable House. There's no doubt that an economy in trouble requires capital spending. We are agreed. The issue, again, is about the choices you make in capital spending. If you are going to engage in capital spending, Mr. Minister of Finance, you need to engage in spending that will have an immediate and direct impact in the economy, and the impact must be quick. Capital spending, even given its lags, is a good way to try and maintain some momentum in the economy. Dream projects like tunnels are useless in this context. This is not a time for dream tunnels, because the benefit will not enter the economic cycle in 5 years, and I suspect under this government, it will take another 20 years before it gets there. And there can be no doubt that the history of implementation of this government is abysmal when it comes to these projects. No wonder direct purchases have become the name of the game in town these days. Given that there is a lag between implementation and output, if the government plan was any good, what the government might have decided to do was target fewer projects more easily capable of being implemented so that its economic impact would be quick and direct. The fact of the matter is, we don't have a buffer anymore. The inaction of the government over the last 2 years has really seriously weakened St. Lucia's ability to counter the current cycle we are in. The 2 years of inaction have been
deadly to this economy. And this is the point that the member of Sozell in another life, in an earlier life last year, short-lived, made in his budget presentation. No tunnel, absolutely no tunnel, will save us now. And I urge the Prime Minister to rethink, recast. If you have committed money, find alternatives quickly and rapidly. In the short term, the government requires people to spend to spur economic activity. By all means, spend responsibly. And careful management can assist that process. Government should, in my view, direct its resources to putting money not only to small businesses and manufacturers, but even that has to be thought out carefully, but more crucially in the pockets of the poor, the workers, and consumers. Now, this may sound like heresy at this time, because it is not an issue of handouts to the poor people of this country. The fact of the matter is, poor people spend more out of income and boost domestic economic activity far more quickly than other sectors, because they are starving, they have real difficulties. So inevitably, once they receive the money, then they're going to spend it to spur economic activity. Likewise, it is true that the government may have lost some revenue if it did so. But a government should have considered a regime of temporary reductions in consumption tax, because this once again would increase disposable income. It is not enough to say that you're increasing and building on the initiatives of the Labour Party, the income tax threshold by $1,000 to $17,000. The multiplier effect of that would be inconsequential. In any event, for all practical purposes, this is cancelled out because they've already capped renovations and the cost of rehabilitation of homes. The reality is, it is that the people who live below that threshold are the ones who are in greatest need of help at this time. What benefits, may I ask? And I ask this in all sincerity for someone who has been pilloried for attempting to change the face of tourism in this country. But a question becomes relevant now. What benefits do we gain from maintaining a bloated budget for tourism, which mostly goes to jaunts and administrative costs? What? Why are we spending $45 million? The evidence is clear. The UK economy is on the ropes. The numbers coming out from the UK are dwindling and dwindling rapidly. The United States, the numbers have already contracted. And if truth be told, you probably will not see any increase in numbers until towards the end of the year, possibly early next year, depending on whether the recovery in the US bites. Canada. As a member for Castries pointed out this morning, always has the potential, but the reality with Canada is this. That economy is now beginning to go into a tailspin. And it may well be that the numbers will fall. I do not add to this the current problems that we have in airlines. But listen, whether you and I like it or not, this economy will not be recovering before the year is out. We have to face the reality of at least 2 years of hard times. That's the reality. We're not going to see an upturn in economic activity perhaps until the middle of next year. question that I ask. Why are we spending $45 million in tourism when we are likely to have so little impact on the marketplace at this time? Should we not be more targeted? Mr. Prime Minister, don't you think that it is better to reduce the budget of the Ministry of Tourism by $10 million and put that $10 million in small projects? And I'm not even going to argue with you your usual practice of discriminating against Labour Party people, because that's your habit and your government. I'm not even going to debate that. What I'm concerned about is the economy and getting some money into this economy as quickly as possible.
Honourable Member, you have 15 minutes left for your presentation.
1.5.
Madam Speaker, I move for the to invoke the relevant standing order to allow the member from Beaufort South an additional
1.5 hours,
an additional 90 minutes.
Honourable members, the question is that standing order 3210 be invoked to allow the Honourable Member from Beaufort South an additional 90 minutes to make his contribution. I now put the question. As many as are of that opinion, say aye.
Aye.
As many as are of a contrary opinion, say no. I think the ayes have it. The ayes have it. Member, proceed.
Sadly, the winds are beginning to change. The winds are beginning to shift. I tell you, stay out of that, you know. Don't get involved with them fellas, I warn you. Madam Speaker, comments have already been made about several of the revenue measures. For my part, I will confine my remarks to two of them. Firstly, the reintroduction of tax on dividends, including a withholding tax on amounts accruing to non-residents. Madam Speaker, civil servants are interesting people. Public officers are very interesting people. When you see they believe in something, they pursue it with incredible passion, they're relentless. And they know when there is weakness and when to pounce on individuals. You can trust them for that. They will psych you off, and then when the time is right, they'll come for you. For years, Madam Speaker, the Inland Revenue Department urged, when I had the honor to serve as Minister of Finance, that such a tax be reintroduced in this country. I resisted. I refused to accede to their request. And I'll tell you why. Attractive as this tax may be, Government of St. Lucia must weigh carefully its potential impact on investment and, secondly, its implications for CARICOM National. Let me address the issue on investment first. And let me say, I don't know whether the Prime Minister is following developments in the rest of the region, but one government in the region, Jamaica, whose economy now is on the ropes, with little future for that country, they have now decided as well to reintroduce that withholding tax in much the same terms as has been suggested here in this budget statement. But you know, it pays to be different. It is important as a little country that we are different. We must never compromise ourselves, our status, and do like everybody else because it is the norm. We must evaluate carefully what we do. There are matters on which we are different, and we must maintain that difference, especially if there is good logic behind it. And let me hasten to add that it was not the St. Lucia Labour Party who introduced the policy of no tax on dividends. We met it, we found it, and we left it alone. The fact of the matter is, with a policy of no taxes on dividends for both nationals and non-residents, St. Lucia became the home of many large companies and multinationals and conglomerates in the region. They were attracted to our shores because they knew that whatever dividends they reported from their business activity in other parts of the world, it would not be liable to taxation. St. Lucians would be astounded by some of the companies that have registered in this country. Indeed, many of the huge energy companies in Trinidad and Tobago have their home office here in St. Lucia. Another one, PriceSmart, now making its way around the region. The equivalent of Big J's established in Trinidad early. PriceSmart home office, at least until recently, and I haven't checked the records, was St. Lucia. It meant that we had a competitive advantage over our neighbors. The former government, for what it is worth, saw the wisdom of the approach and began to market St. Lucia as a destination for companies looking for a safe and secure environment. With one stroke, we are destroying that. There is value in being special. The fact that Jamaica has gone down that route is good reason for us not to go, so that we maintain the essential difference that we have. What is more disconcerting is this. Under the policy, both CARICOM as well as now local nationals were invited to invest in this country. And we saw the value of that. St. Lucia Electricity Services, there were investors from CARICOM. And this is not my policy, by the way. Lucilec was divested years ago. The Bank of St. Lucia, both the Republic Bank of Trinidad and Tobago, NIS in Barbados, and several Caribbean nationals invested in that bank. But on the CARICOM nationals, the Minister of Finance has given no indication how they will be treated under this regime. Does it mean, therefore, that we are going to agree to discriminate against CARICOM nationals who invest in this country? If it is the intention of the Minister of Finance that he is particularly concerned about the foreign banks operating in this country because they are remitting substantial amounts of profits earned in the domestic market, then clearly there are other mechanisms to deal with that. Why punish the entire Caribbean community? What I'm really asking is this. Couldn't the perceived abuses in the system, as reported by the Inland Revenue Department, be tackled by other means at this time? Is this a signal we want to send to investors that if they invest in this country and they make profits, then they are compelled to spend their profits in a certain way? Do we really want to do this now in this environment, tempting as it is to get the money? Can we not find another way to achieve perhaps some of the results? Because I understand the emotional argument. I understand the argument that they are foreigners, they are making money here, and therefore they should put back in the country. But what you don't want to do is to kill the goose that lays the golden egg, because you're going to take away that money and go elsewhere. And the investment that you need, you're not going to get it. You're going to get a flight of capital. That's what it's going to do. and you really want to go that way, at this time? But you know, I listened to the very impassioned plea of the Minister of Communications and Works defending the reintroduction of license fees on the Eagles. He was really passionate. And indeed, I saw him, Madam Speaker, recently in a church. We happened to share a similar service, believe it or not, in my constituency some months ago, and I saw the passion too. We tried to. But there was some passion. So now he's busy trying to reinvent the past. So this is really the problem of this government. Everything that it left behind prior to 1997, it is busy reintroducing the same thing. And you want an example, Madam Speaker, I can give you one. You know, in my constituency, Madam Speaker, in my constituency in Beaufort, there are people living on government land for years, 30 years, 20 years, 25 years. They have built their homes out of concrete or whatever it is. Just as the United Workers Party did prior to 1997, it has now imposed another condition on these people, telling them that if you do not enter into a lease agreement with NDC, you will not get water connection. Back to the old habits. It doesn't matter to them that these people have been living on these lands for years. It does not matter to them that there was a fraud program allowing those persons to purchase the lands on which they live. Doesn't matter. We are reinventing the past. And I'll come to NDC in a few minutes. It is not a policy of this government. It is right at the door of NDC, which has a minister. NDC is terrorizing the people of Beaufort. They are terrorizing the people of Beaufort. It's the same way when I spoke about the marketing board, not a policy of government. It is $5 million in the red. Nobody knows about it. Madam Speaker, the minister hopes that this measure will yield $7 million in revenue. So once again, vehicle owners, they have to go and line up in the licensing office or wherever the designated place is to go and pay $150 on a vehicle. The administrative costs don't matter. And I heard the minister making the point about defaulting drivers and the deaths on our roads. All of us ought to be concerned about deaths on our roads. But two of the most serious deaths, the most incomprehensible deaths occurred in two accidents. And in both instances, it was not an issue of the vehicles. It was an issue of the drivers. They're not having licenses to drive. What are we talking about? The police can't even enforce the insurance requirements, and yet the insurance requirements are the most important of all the requirements for the simple reason that you're dealing with people's lives. But we want to recreate the past because we think we need to make a point. It doesn't matter if it's time wasting. It doesn't matter if it's going to cause more frustration and more anger. The notion that you're going to pay a vehicle license is no guarantee of increased compliance. That's no guarantee. In fact, when you check the figures prior to 1997 or 1998, when the measure was introduced, the compliance rate was low. And it's unfortunate because my own view is that we need to minimize bureaucracy for people. We have to make people accountable, yes. Yes, we have to do that. We have to hold people responsible for what they do, but we don't burden them. We don't add more government to them at every twist and turn. We shouldn't become control freaks in everything that we do. One thing is clear. The proposed $7 million in revenue will never be realized. And I await next year's budget if I'm around. I now turn, Madam Speaker, to this debt issue. I touched it briefly, but I want to talk about it as a separate item. Because I really want to say to this government, think hard about what you're doing. I noted earlier that the government of St. Lucia is proposing to borrow to finance this budget $265,959,414. Now, Madam Speaker, I really have no idea whether member for Castries Southeast gets his logic or his mathematics from. I know he said publicly that I'm not fit to tie his shoelaces, but I hope you bear with me this once as I go through some figures. The first thing I want to do is to indicate to him what are the real facts of how much money this government has borrowed. I will cite instruments and amounts. Statutory instrument number 16 of 2007. The government sought authorization for 1.3 million special drawing rights, which translated to 1.91 million US dollars, because one drawing right is roughly equivalent to US $1.47. Statutory instrument number 17 of 2007. The government borrowed US $12 million. Statutory instrument number 18 of 2007, the government borrowed US $12 million. Statutory instrument number 19 of 2007, the government sought 3 million special drawing rights, the equivalent of US $4.41 million. Statutory instrument number 169 of 2007, the government borrowed $2.4 million. Statutory instrument number 53 of 2008, the government borrowed EC $120 million. Statutory instrument number 94 of 2008, the government borrowed US $3 million. Statutory instrument number 2 of 2009, the government borrowed another 120 million, but it said that was to refinance the previous borrowing, so we can cancel that one out. Statutory instrument number 1 of 2009, the government borrowed EC $25 million. Statutory instrument number 3 of 2009, the government borrowed another US $30 million, that is the CDB loan. In total, and this is where the member for Castries Southeast must consider what he said this morning. In total, this government has borrowed in 2.5 years the EC equivalent of $322 million. When this amount, so it can't be 50 million. You've borrowed 322 million in 2 years. 100-something odd million in a year. How come earth cannot work out under any circumstance to 15 million? When this amount is added to the proposed amount for this budget, then also this government would have borrowed approximately EC $587 million. I'm not even going to talk about billions. And I am pretty certain that it'll have to come back this year again. But amazingly, and this is the problem, amazingly, you are borrowing $587 million. And I suspect it's probably more than that, and I'll get to the bottom of it. Each time the government borrows, it attacks the opposition. Each time. Each time, as if the opposition is the one guiding the Prime Minister to come to this house and borrow money. Each single time. When will the double standard end? The tragedy of all of this is that this government, in opposition and in office, has demonized borrowing and given the people of this country that it is wrong to borrow. Now they must swallow their own vomit. And engage in borrowing huge sums of money, now more than ever, to block this huge hole in the economy. As I said, had the moral position of this government been different, had this government said to the opposition, look, our little island is in trouble, our country is in trouble, we have to find a way out. This is what the other islands are doing. And I'll come to this. It is true that we do not have as much room to maneuver, but can we agree on a way forward on debt to ensure that we pull this country from the abyss? And I said we have examples all over the world at this time. But interestingly, let's just look at the statistics from the ECC, the Eastern Caribbean Central Bank. It is said that we destroyed this country by borrowing. And I'm taking the opportunity to go through these statistics to give you an indication of what the position is in other member states of the Eastern Caribbean. I will quote only the figures for 2008. In the case of Antigua and Barbuda, the total public sector outstanding debt in percent of GDP, debt to GDP, is currently 88%. And Antigua comes from a high of 148.4%. Now they're at 88%. In Dominica, and incidentally the Dominican economy grew by 3.8% this year. In Dominica, correct, 3.8%. While we languish in, they grew by 3.8%. In Dominica, in 2008, they at 93.2% from a high in 2003 of 131.2%. In Grenada, they are at 2008 at 107.3%, from a high, if you like, of 109.5% in 2005. Montserrat, for all practical purposes, I will ignore Montserrat because of its special situation and what it is going through. St. Kitts and Nevis. The debt GDP ratio in St. Kitts and Nevis stands at 170.3% from a high of 187% in 2005. These are not my statistics. These are on a website. These are ECCB statistics. That's I'm accused now of in the fairway statistics, manipulating statistics. In St. Vincent and the Grenadines, they are now at 69.2%, just about where St. Lucia is, and they are coming down from a high of 84.2%. St. Lucia, as I said to you, we are currently at 70.1 at 2008, according to the ECCB, expected to rise to well over that this year, and we are coming down from a high, interestingly, in 2007, of 73.9, not under Labour government, the high was under this government, 73.9. Now, Prime Minister, these are the statistics. These are the statistics, and nothing you can do can alter that. When you look at the reality, therefore, St. Lucia has room to maneuver. St. Lucia is nowhere near the situation of other member states, but let us leave no doubt that in this period, it clearly has to be carefully managed to avert disaster. I now turn to the very vexed issue of payments to public officers. Several persons in the media have assailed the St. Lucia Labour Party on the ground that there is a crisis involving the payment of salaries to public officers, and we have remained silent. The opposition has listened carefully to the arguments of the government that it is unable to pay the second tranche of the 14.5% award of public officers. Second or third, whatever. 10.5%. Whatever. In truth and in fact, what has happened to this government has happened to other governments in the region before. There is a situation right now in Jamaica where the Jamaican Prime Minister, and this seems to be the example that this Ministry of Finance is following, is attempting to do the same thing, but did so in a different way from this Prime Minister. Many, many years ago, governments in the region got into trouble. I recall the government of Trinidad and Tobago got in trouble, the government of Dominica got in trouble, and the most famous example is Barbados. Just prior to an election, the then Prime Minister of Barbados, Mr. Sandiford, awarded a significant increase, and then immediately after the general election, he had to undergo an IMF structural adjustment program and had to reduce salaries by 8%. Now forgive me, I may be a little nostalgic on a personal note. I am fully aware of this because I am one of those who went up to the Privy Council to defend the Barbados government on this matter. So I know the consequences of these problems. And happily, it did succeed at the Privy Council and the government of Barbados was saved. So what has happened here is not unique. What is at issue is how the matter was handled, how the Prime Minister handled this matter, how he communicated to civil servants. That is what is at issue. Our natural instincts on this side of the house are with our workers, a promise in trade union language is a debt, and promises in collective bargaining agreements are sacred. But there are some very troubling issues where this is concerned. I have shown you, Madam Speaker, that on the evidence presented in this budget by the Prime Minister and Minister of Finance, there is no credible evidence that the government cannot pay. The Prime Minister has presented no evidence that they cannot pay in this budget because he has presented a budget that admits there is a crisis but does not show what the depth of the crisis is. What do you expect civil servants to believe? What do you expect teachers to believe? Maybe if you had told the real truth of the predicament of the people of St. Lucia, the problems that we have, then they might have listened to you. I have demonstrated that the Minister of Finance claimed in his budget that there was a dramatic decline in revenue. I have shown that is not the case. In fact, revenue increased over the previous year, albeit at a slower rate. You need to convince people, irrespective of whether they believe civil servants are liming, irrespective of whether they believe civil servants are not given their 8 hours, irrespective of whether they believe the civil service is too bloated, you need to convince people that there is a problem because $25 million does not appear on the surface, in this budget at least, to be a monumental challenge, and we shall come to this. I said there are troubling issues. How on earth can a Minister of Finance agree to a 14.5% increase in August 2008 when the entire world was in the middle or entering into economic decline? How could you have done that? The issue is not whether public servants deserve the increase. That is not the issue. And I'm not going to be debating that. The point is, how can anyone with competence agree to pay the final 7.5% increase in April 2009 when it was acknowledged that economies would be in the middle of a downturn? It was no secret. All the signs were there. Does it really make any sense at all? Then how does the Minister of Finance only realize that he cannot pay during the final few days of preparing the budget when its figures do not add up? And if you are to be believed that it's $25 million your problem, there's only $25 million more you needed to close to balance your budget. Simple logic. But you know, the ministers in this cabinet need to ask themselves some serious questions. Who's in charge of cash flow management in the Ministry of Finance? Who really is in charge of financial management in the country? And I have warned this Prime Minister and warned this government. It is unlawful. It is illegal to have one person serving as Director of Finance and Permanent Secretary together. It is wrong. Why is it wrong? Because the legislation of this country provides specific functions for the Director of Finance and specific functions under the Constitution for the Permanent Secretary. There is a way that I keep on repeating things and I am ignored. I will say this for the very last time, that the government of St. Lucia must move to separate the post of the Director of Finance and the Permanent Secretary. The last thing that I would say. And if no action is taken, then I'll know where to go to get the matter resolved. Then rest assured. I sometimes wonder whether the problem is that the minister cannot understand the figures and documents when they are brought to his attention, or whether his officers are telling him the truth, or he has time for him, or they have time for him, or is it that he could not care less? It didn't matter to him because he was solely consumed about his political survival, and therefore, in an act of recklessness to ensure peace in the country, you agree to a 14.5% increase in August when the curtains are down and economies are in trouble. And this is a troubling part. When one considers the amount, $25 million, it does not appear to be insurmountable. And let's look at it. Let's look at it. The government has a $20 million allocated to its capital contingency. And I intend to follow that up because never in my life have I seen a capital contingency made up of a loan from a bank. I've never known the Caribbean Development Bank to give you loans for a capital contingency. I rest there and say no more until I find out. Then you measure the $25 million against the planned borrowing of $265 million. Does it make sense? You're borrowing $265 million. All of a sudden, $25 million to public offices are a problem. But let me just say this in all seriousness to the Minister of Finance. A while ago, I mentioned that I had the opportunity to argue a case for the Barbados government before the Privy Council. Incidentally, the chairman of your commission was on the other side. Don't say that publicly. He was on the other side. He was representing the claimant in that case. But the greatest danger is postponing increases is that it becomes a stranglehold. Let me explain. First, it is doubtful that the economy would have recovered by next year to pay this $25 million if you truly cannot save. Because next year, this fiscal year rather, this financial year, this economy is going to contract even more as the downturn in tourism bites. It's going to contract even more. So you're not going to be able to pay it unless you decide to bite the bullet and go and borrow. If you don't pay the $25 million, then it means that the delayed back pay for that year, you'll also have to pay it, and therefore the amount increases exponentially. It then becomes a stranglehold. Because you're now putting an economy that may just be showing little signs of recovery under extraordinary stress. I want to suggest that this government thinks very hard about this matter. If this economy is doomed to further contraction, how then could the government expect to pay the accumulated amount in a year's time or even in 6 months' time? That's the question that I'm raising. It is unfortunate that the usual platitudes found their way into this budget presentation. Year in, year out, we hear the platitudes about wastage in the public service. And let me say this. A former government, which I had the honor to lead, is as guilty as this government. I too made these statements about wastage, curbing wastage. I too made statements about controlling the wastage on our roads, about the unauthorized use of government vehicles. But you know, Mr. Prime Minister, when you talk about wastage of vehicles, your government is not setting the example on this matter. Let me make the point that when the Labour government was in office, ministers of the Labour government were not allowed to go shopping with government vehicles or take government vehicles to their homes because they were told in clear language that they got a traveling allowance on their salary and then they only use a government vehicle for official business but never for private business. They were very unhappy. They didn't like it. Only recently they reminded me about it, but not this government. You have your ministers driving around the place, and if you want names and numbers and SSGs, I can give it to you. Driving around the place in government vehicles, taking government vehicles to their homes. Which, what's the number? 3010. But it seems to me that there is an aspect of this wastage that we never discuss in public. That is the incidence of theft in the public service. It's like taboo. We are afraid to touch it. Every year, millions of dollars are lost because of theft in the public service. And again, I want to make my point clear that just as it is occurring in this government, it also occurred in the government that I manage. And it was an extraordinary problem because prosecuting a public officer for a variety of reasons became exceedingly difficult and complex. I want to mention to this House incidents that have currently occurred that we are not being told about. In the Beaufort Miku sub-treasuries, there's an amount of $450,000 unaccounted for. It has disappeared. It involves the collection of driver's license and liquor license fees and putting these collections to personal use. The misappropriation covers the period 2003-2007. And the officer at the center of this issue has skipped the country. I'm not going to mention names, but I'm certain a member for Miku North knows the name. 2003-2007.
The amazing thing about this case was that when the individual was arrested by the Miku police, the individual's passport was held pending full completion of the report. No one to this day knows how she managed to get her passport to travel. Unofficially, the arresting officer, whom I will not name, had said that he received a lot of pressure from some very powerful person, Madam Speaker. We will find out. Go and ask the investigating officers. In the general post office in Castries, an amount of $1.5 million is unaccounted for. Right there. It involves a misappropriation of funds, cash issued to the senior cashier for onward distribution to various counter clerks or clerks at the general post office and other sub-offices as Marshall or Clary, etc., for encashment of money and postal orders issued by the countries of the International Postal Union, mainly the United Kingdom and the United States. We want to find out in what year the scam covered the period 2003-2008. Again, I will not name names, but the officer at the center of the matter has skipped the country. That's it. It's an extraordinary thing. There is a facility for criminals to skip this country with such ease. And the recent example is there before our eyes of the young man against whom allegations have been made. Same set of problems, although lesser amounts in respect of collection of certain market dues in Soufre. And in that instance, it is interesting that the police has completed its investigations and has forwarded the relevant files to the Director of Public Prosecutions for direction over 1 year ago. To this day, they have received no response from the DPP. The question is, why are these matters occurring with such frequency in the public service of the country? And why is it, if we are talking of wastage, we do not have the political will to confront the problem head on? And I readily say that the former government is as much to blame as the present government. I know of an instance when the government of St. Lucia issued bonds, an officer in the Ministry of Finance arranged to have bonds registered in the names of a certain friend and at the appropriate time cash the bonds which the friend held and then shared the returns of the bond. They too have skipped the country. That's the usual trend. But this leads me to tackle another issue head on. Madam, Mr. Speaker, I turn now to the award of contracts to the various projects in this country. You see, the implementation of this budget relies on the award of contracts. People have to be given contracts so that they can implement. And there are some issues. So, Speaker, contracts in this country are either awarded by bidding through advertisements, and of course this takes various forms. When you want to go in a certain direction, you adopt the form that best suits you. And of course, by direct purchase. Now, I want to explain this. The route of direct purchase involves a contract that is directly awarded by the Prime Minister. The normal route is that the Permanent Secretary writes the Prime Minister, invites the Prime Minister to exercise his powers of direct purchase under the procurement and stores regulations. And often reliance is made on Section 9. Section 9 of the Procurement and Stores Regulations. It simply says, the Minister may issue directions for the procurement of goods and services by tender or by direct purchase, and for the sale of stores by tender or direct sale. These rules do not say much more, but simply give the Prime Minister the power to decide who he's going to give a contract for, and he will do so on the advice of his permanent secretaries and his minister. It was a permanent, Mr. Speaker, that these days the norm is to grant contracts by direct purchase once those contracts are not financed by an international agency, for example, the Caribbean Development Bank or the World Bank, although the World Bank has assisted with direct purchases in one or two cases. Only recently, the Minister of Education, in a written reply to a question in this House, advised that in the case of his ministry, the following contracts were awarded by direct purchase. Now, I must say, Madam Speaker, that in all my years as a parliamentarian, I've never ever seen such a detailed response, because the distinguished minister was at pains to explain why he did what he did. This is his response, and he gives you a long video to explain this. I think it's a good thing to do, but good as it may be to do, sometimes you have to go below the hidden, below the line to understand the nuances. He says in his my response to this House that he gave direct purchase contracts as follows. The extension of Chai Secondary to Hippolyte Equipment Services, $850,000. Bokai Secondary, 3 classroom block extension, total development construction, $430,000. Venrez, I believe this is a foreign company, $142,426 for the importation of students' chairs. We finally seem to have a problem because the chairs have to be imported. I thought the local guys would have been able to do that. You must talk to him. Metal importation of teachers' furniture, metal designs concept, $342,393.60. Replacement of 234-year-old pumps at Catskills Comprehensive School, FDM Phil Index Limited, $26,105. Reference materials for Resource Center, Findlay Education Limited, $31,225. Online Library for Learning, Resource Center, IBESCO, all foreign, $40,753. And then NASCO Mathematics Reference Materials for School, $80,768. From Verez in Canada, Student Chairs, Transportation and Handling, $1,700, $45,420, and another $6,000 for handling. M. Decom, a company from Trinidad, student debt, $742,000, teacher's debt, $345,000, teacher's chair, $720,000, $38,000, and it goes on and on and on and on. I said, Madam Speaker, I applaud the fact that he attempted to explain why he advised the Minister of Finance, although the Minister did not clarify for me who got the contract to extend the technical school in Beaufort, and that is a matter we will probe in due course. All right, we'll come to that in a minute. I have no fear. As I said, the powers of direct purchase was given to the Minister of Finance under the Procurement and Stores Regulations. I will readily admit and point out that during my tenure as Minister of Finance, I did issue contracts. But I believe that the record will show that the highest amount that I dared to give a direct contract was in the vicinity, and I cannot now remember because I do not have the records, of $5.5 million, never beyond that, to C.O. Williams and Company to construct the road in the Grand Rivière area. Reason, because it will be recalled that there was an urgency about it since the minibus drivers had gone on strike at the time. During the month of March 2009, I am advised that the finance minister issued direct purchase contracts in the amount of $22 million. One man in this country, the Minister of Finance, awarding contracts to that value. The Minister of Finance is free to rebut what I have said. But bear in mind that once he rebuts, I want total and full disclosure. I'll tell you why. This year might be the first year that procurement by direct purchase has outstripped procurement via the Central Tenders Board and the Department Tenders Board. For the period January 2008 to March 2009, the Ministry of Finance has issued a minimum of 80 direct purchases with a total value of $80 million. You tell me, if Section 9 of the procurement rules was ever intended to be abused in this manner, you tell me whether that was the intention. You tell me whether it is right in this country, a country under which we live, under a constitution, for which we are entitled to be treated fairly by the government in power, for the Prime Minister of this country to approve contracts of $80 million. You tell me if it is right. And there are two interesting ones. There are two interesting ones. Again, if I am giving this House misleading information, then the Minister of Finance has the time and the opportunity to reply and to castigate. Honorable members will recall the efforts of the former government to construct a senior citizen's home. Honorable members will recall that we agreed that the old citizen's home had malgratuits. It was unfair to the elderly of this country, and we need to be far more civilized in the treatment of senior citizens. And we propose to make those lands, to yield those lands for tourism development and to construct a citizen's home at Opika in Beaufort. The area of land was selected, identified, and it was agreed that the money from the sale of the land at Malvisit would go to the construction of the Opika. Now, I am not going to go into the details today of the behavior of the government and the developers, Madam Speaker, regarding the selection of lawyers for that project. Because that is a sordid story that really ought to be reported to the disciplinary committee of the bar and to who got that contract in the end. I'm not going to go there. I will leave it there for the time being. But lo and behold, this government decides that Opika is the wrong place, and they might well be right. I'm not fighting that. To build the old people's home, the senior citizens' home, my apologies, and construct it in Black Bay. Neither the parliamentary representative for Labrie nor the parliamentary representative before were ever consulted. All we saw were tractors moving and clearing the land. That is all we saw. But who got the contract? By virtue of a direct purchase order, a company called Grantor was awarded a contract to construct the senior citizens' home for $6.5 million. Direct purchase. No advertisement. Who is Grantor? Who is Grantor and why was Grantor given that contract? The records at the company's registry show that Grantor is a company registered by one Eden Legrand of Auger Vieux-Fort, the other being one Michael Chitoli of Palmist Estate, Savans Bay, Vieux-Fort, who is currently the chairman of the Vieux-Fort Town Council, and who, until recent times, had made a fortune from importing tires, fruit, and vegetables for retailing. Mr. Legrand is a taxi driver, and at one time, almost became an unofficial dentist for the people of the South, because he was a dental assistant before he became a full-time taxi driver, and he rendered extraordinary service to the people of the Vieux-Fort South. Where does Michael Chitoli suddenly get the experience as a contractor to be awarded a contract to build a senior citizen's home for $6.5 million? Anybody can be a contractor, eh? Anybody, no wonder you are starting to get into trouble over stones. Anybody can be a stone crusher. Anybody can be a contractor. That is not so. $6.5 million by direct purchase. Likewise, a direct purchase order to one roadway construction owned by John Javati for $355,000 to construct houses in Soufre. Did you know that? George Jabatis is a tire and an auto accessories dealer and has no experience in building construction. Again, no tendering. Direct purchase. This is our country today. This is our country today. But I'm sorry that the Minister for Communications and Works has spoken. But he can always speak to his agent in this house. He can get someone to reply for him. I'm not talking about the one in the upper house. Because you see, this is a minister who only recently this morning repeatedly makes a big fuss about foreigners getting jobs in this country. And I think all of us heard in this morning how he broke the logjam and did what the former administration could not do. Out of the blue, out of nowhere, a company calling itself Asphalt and Mining St. Lucia Limited says, by virtue of a sign at the commencement of the Alan Bousquet Highway, that it has been awarded to rehabilitate the Alan Bousquet Highway. The sign says so. The sign. As I said, amazingly, this sign goes up. There is no line item in the budget for this rehabilitation of the Alan Bousquet Highway. So we now have two major projects occurring in St. Lucia where there is no allocation in your capital budget. And the question is why? Is it a case that if the Prime Minister and the Minister of Finance had put in these two amounts, then what would have happened was that the budget again would have been out of sync and it wouldn't balance because of the cost? Or is it a case of a policy that the prices of the contracts are not told up front so that in the event, when it is said later, they can proudly announce no cost overrun? I want to find out. No one knows if this contract was awarded and how this contract was awarded. The company's registry provides the following details about this company.
And I can assure you, Madam Speaker, because I heard you this morning emphasizing the need for evidence. So I am going to provide the evidence because we need to know who this company is and where this company came from. Madam Speaker, this company appears to be owned by three entities. Papaya Holdings Limited Company, Papaya Holdings Limited, coming to that. Domingo Moya, a businessman, and Antonio Asenza, another businessman. The company met and appointed its directors. The directors are the directors of this company are the company Papaya Holdings Limited, represented by one Andre Edgar, and they have 5% of the issued shares. Domingo Moya has 20% of the issued shares, and Mr. Antonio Asenza has 75% of the issued shares. Where did they come from? Who are they? I thought we had enough contractors in this country to do our roads. What is the track record of this company? And most important, how much was allocated for this road, because it was mentioned by the Minister of Finance in his budget. And there are further details about who is the secretary and who is not the secretary. But I leave it there because I expect to get the explanations. So I now await for the Minister of Communications and Works to clarify the origins of this company. And if a contract was awarded, the value of the contract, by what means, and how it was granted. But you know, the longest rope must have an end, huh? For 2.5 years, the opposition has protested and pleaded with the government to bring an end to the financing of parliamentarians and their project outside of the financial system by the Taiwanese government. It is on record that, save for the member for Miku North, who has ensured that the $1 million allocated to her constituency is made available to the Social Investment Fund and her village council, the cause of the opposition on this matter has gone unheeded. Now, we are beginning to see the appearance of new devices in constituencies to receive funds to manage government projects. I want to take the first one. Madam Speaker, last year, an organization itself, calling itself the Ancillary Canaries Constituency Development Committee, made an appearance. This organization employed several persons, allegedly, among other things, on beautification projects and other small projects. The signatories to these checks was one John Medrick and the other Mr. Griffith. And they purported to pay amounts of $400, $500. Now, one thing is clear. The money for these projects did not come from the Treasury, because the Treasury would not have allowed a payment by this method. Madam Speaker, let's there is a belief that I'm exaggerating, I have with me checks of payments. I have deliberately removed the names and the check numbers because they can trace the person to whom the checks were paid. But at any time, I am prepared to make the names available if and only if the individuals could be protected. The question is this. How is it possible for the Ansari Canary's Constituency Development Committee to be in possession of so much money that it can employ persons to undertake work of government trust, on government land, on government buildings? But we are also beginning to see the emergence of some new entities. And in this edition of the Business Focus, March 2009, I noticed that in the Castries Southeast Development, in the Castries Southeast constituency, there is a company registered as Castries Southeast Development Foundation Corporation, and its activities are listed to develop the Southeast Castries constituency.
A document of the House, sir, please.
Madam Speaker, I am delighted to make it a document of the House. And then, Madam Speaker, if you turn, there is another one, Madam Speaker. Castries North Development Council Incorporated. Activities, community development. Activities, community development. So, we have a new creativity, new entities being created ostensibly to develop constituencies outside of the formalities of the machinery of government. I conclude, before I turn to my constituency very briefly, by referring to what I regard as an ominous statement in the budget presentation. At page 50 of the Prime Minister's budget, he announces that it is the government's intention to access, quote, the so-called exogenous shock facility of the International Monetary Fund. As if sensing danger, he says, quote, all that is required of government is a continued commitment to sound macroeconomic policy, and in particular, policies to address the shock. So we are told that the government of St. Lucia will access funds from the IMF under its exogenous shock facility, provided that the government maintains sound macroeconomic policy. Of course, we don't know what this sound macroeconomic policy is and what conditionalities are we speaking of. But I will not make bold to say that I expect these conditionalities at this time to be severe, given the situation that we are in. Apparently, the doors of the IMF will be open, albeit slightly. The real question is, how wide? The Minister of Finance must answer at this time to the entire country. He must tell us whether there are doubts about the financial management of this country that will force us to go down the road of the IMF, and watch my words carefully. Either as an individual country on our own, or as part of a group of countries within the OECS or the wider Caribbean. The Prime Minister must tell us categorically whether there is any likelihood of consideration being given for countries within the OECS or otherwise to approach the IMF collectively in this period. I repeat, is there not sufficient concern that this country is being so badly managed that we will have no choice but to go to the IMF for assistance? Is that a likelihood? Is that a possibility? Is it something we need to begin to think about? Already we know that the Ministry of Finance is being so badly led and managed that a regional institution has to make available to the government of St. Lucia a consultant to advise and guide the government to prepare this budget after the fiasco of the karaoke budget of last year. I know. Mr. Prime Minister, this country is consumed with hopelessness. It needs a leadership that has vision, understands strategic responses, can inspire ideas and generate creativity, and is strong enough to allocate resources as required, and is willing to make the tough decisions, but fair decisions. Like your predecessor, whom you admire and emulate so much, I too believe that there is no place for the IMF in the affairs, in the management of the affairs of the country. I now turn, Madam Speaker, very briefly, because this is the first time in 3 years I will have an opportunity to address issues pertaining to my constituency. Madam Speaker, I do not believe that any constituency should be made to suffer because of where the people of the constituency voted or because of the person who is representing the constituency. People of Beaufort, numbers of students, persons in the area have been able to rent out homes, extend their homes to allow the students to rent, and at the same time these students purchase goods and services within the community. In recent times, the offshore medical sector has expanded to the north of the island, and in the north we have about 3 or 4 are these offshore medical schools. There is now a major problem. A problem that had been identified in the closing years of the administration that I led, but which now needs to be tackled. A country gets its reputation by a variety of means. But when a country engages in international investment or international practice, then it has the opportunity to market its reputation. Because the offshore medical sector is attracting students from all over the world, from as far as Asia, India, Pakistan, the United States, Eastern Europe, Africa, it means that there is an international dimension to the training that is offered here. I do not know whether the government is aware of the fact that some of the medical schools operating in St. Lucia have been
expressly denying the recognition by licensing authorities in the United States and in the United Kingdom. Indeed, I invite anyone to go through the websites of the various states to examine which medical schools are allowed recognition by these licensing bodies. And when you look at the list, there are some prominent medical schools in St. Lucia that those particular states refuse to recognize the graduates of these schools. Only recently, the government of India issued a statutory rule and order listing medical schools for which recognition will not be extended. Again, there are medical schools in St. Lucia in that list. I say this to suggest that the time has come for us to take these medical schools in hand, because there is a problem of accreditation of these schools, a very serious problem. The problem is that there is a mismatch between our requirements here and the requirements in the United States. We need to rectify this very quickly, and I want to urge the government to give consideration to enacting legislation to govern the operations of these medical schools institutions. I want to suggest as well that we give urgent consideration to shifting the responsibility for the accreditation process of these medical schools from the Ministry of Health to the Ministry of Education, so that the appropriate follow-up can be made. Either way, it is necessary for a special unit to be established. Madam Speaker, my constituency, Beaufort South, awaits another year. My constituency knows why it has been discriminated against. But in all of this, they will remain proud and defiant. Madam Speaker, I thank you.